Dive into Six Music on the BBC Sounds app and discover all our latest shows, sessions and mixes.
Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time.
Takes over. I don't wait till it's over. I bathe in its waves. To the sea from the river, I'm swept and pulled under. I will never recover. I won't be the same.
I'm Matt Everett and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the first pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today. My guest on this episode is one of the most distinctive and original songwriters to emerge from the US alternative scene in the past 20 years. Born in Chicago, they've channeled a fiercely independent spirit and deeply personal lyrics into a run of albums, 7 solo and 3 with their early band, that have won over hearts across the world. Stylistically unpredictable, often brutally raw, gorgeously melodic one moment and aggressively punk the next, we here in the UK fell in love with the album Day of the Dog in 2013 and their breakthrough single My Zero, and that connection has only deepened ever since. I'm very happy to welcome to The First Time Ezra Furman, and you just heard Grand Mal, the opening track from Ezra's latest album Goodbye Small Head. In this show, we discuss Ezra's childhood and early influences, Green Day and Lou Reed, and their adventures with their first groups, including Ezra Furman and the Harpoons. We also cover the success of singles like My Zero and Love You So Bad, the brilliant work Ezra did on the soundtrack to the TV series Sex Education, and their decision to focus on the Trump administration for the 12 Nudes album in 2022, and of course, their latest release, Goodbye Small Head. But I started by asking Ezra, as I do with all my guests, when were they first aware of music as a child?
I think dancing around in my parents' living room to Paul Simon's Graceland, or possibly maybe the same day even, howling along to Warren Zevon's Werewolves of London as a small child, dancing with my older brother there too.
I saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for the place called Lee Ho Fooks, gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein.
Tell me about that living room. Paint a picture. What was it like? Did you have the big stereo in the corner? Like, give me the whole... What was it
okay,
like?
Okay, yeah, sure. There's a rug on the ground and a couch. I think there were 2 blue chairs that could spin around in those days. And the record player's kind of in the corner. There's sunshine coming in through these 3 windows in a row. And, yeah, room enough to move around to the buoyant sounds of Graceland.
The Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar. I am following the river down the highway through the cradle of the Civil War. I'm
see I'm going to Graceland. Poor boys and pilgrims with families, and we are going to Graceland. My traveling companion is 9 years old. He is the child of my first marriage. But I've reason to believe we both will be received in Graceland.
Was that a reasonably common occurrence in your house? Was kind of dancing to music a thing that kind of happened?
I don't know. My parents stopped listening to records at some point. But I remember when I was young, we were doing it all the time. We'd also listen to Monty Python records together, which I didn't even understand for my whole childhood that there were visuals that sometimes accompanied.
All right, that's cool.
I just thought these were insane audio recordings, and they are.
I want two, three, four.
Half a bee, philosophically, must ipso facto half not be. But half the bee has got to be vis-a-vis its entity. Do you see? But can a bee be said to be or not to be an entire bee when half the bee is not a bee due to some ancient injury? Singing.
La-dee-dee, a 1, 2, 3. Eric the half a bee. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Eric the half a bee. Is this a wretched demi-bee? Half asleep upon my knee. Some freak from a menagerie. No, it's Eric the half a bee.
It's not like music was clear to me that it would be central to my life when I was a little kid. I only got obsessed with it a little bit later.
What was that first record or the first artist that you were obsessed with as a little kid? Was the first one you kind of recognized as being, okay, I like this particular musician or song or whatever?
Well, there was a formative time when I had this cassette tape that I think my father brought home. It was the top 10 hits of 1961. U.S. Billboard charts. And I listened to it all the time on headphones alone in my bedroom at night. It became kind of mystical to me. This, I like felt such enormous feelings about this music from 1961. So it had like Del Shannon's Runaway on it. It had Tossin' and Turnin' by Bobby Lewis. There's some doo-wop on there. And there's Run Around Sue by Dion.
Here's my story, it's sad but true. It's about a girl that I once knew. She took my love, then ran around with every single guy in town.
Out with other guys, here's the moral and the story from the guy who knows. I fell in love and my love
was because it was the first emotional music I was ever listening to on headphones. I think I had gotten the cassette player and headphones pretty recently too. And as this experience to go through alone, I was like, this is so, there's just something like beautiful happening here. I didn't realize that music could be like this. I don't know. It was like my first moment of what felt like deep connection to music. But then there was the other watershed moment was punk.
Okay.
I mean, I've had lots of watershed moments, but yeah, it was when I was 12 years old that I heard the band Green Day. And I think that I just hadn't heard, I mean, alternative rock radio had been on and stuff, and I was kind of aware of various bands, but not like that. That spirit of, I think it was especially 12 years old, I was not like doing well socially, I would say. I was kind of felt like a misfit kid. And sometimes I was like, maybe there's something wrong with me. I'm so, such a hard time socially. And anyway, this music came into my life via Green Day and then a bunch of other bands in the wake of that, that was like, raise the banner high for being like a messed up person, you know? And like, maybe that's your greatest strength. You don't want to fit in. And yeah, screw their standards. I never thought of that. I never like thought of that stance, that you could reject the standards that had been set up as like, this is what success as a person means. I needed it. I needed it, and I became obsessed with it. And then, yeah, somehow from that, I was like, I dove right into to real good punk bands. I don't know how exactly it didn't so much lead me to like Rancid or anything, or like Blink-182. It led me to the Sex Pistols and the Ramones and the Clash, and I was just off and running, and this is all that matters to me.
What's the punk track we should play at that juncture that first springs to mind when you're thinking about that moment in your life?
Well, if you went with the first thing I heard, it would be track one on the album Dookie, which is Burnout. Yeah, I declare I don't care no more. What a thing to hear.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that you kind of initially thought that you were going to be a writer or a comedian. But when did you first think, actually, I want to be a musician? Was that what the punk ignited in you? Okay, I could do this too.
Well, the thing was, I met this kid who had a guitar and he was like, punk music is easy. I can't even remember his name. And I really feel like I owe him a lot. I wish I could credit him by name. But he was like, yeah, you learn like one chord and move it around and you've kind of got most of the punk songs we like. And so I was like, yeah, I want to get a guitar and do that. I didn't feel like I was going to become a musician. It wasn't like the path is clear before me. I don't think in college when I started a band, and even when I got a record deal when I was still in college, I still wasn't like, this is going to be my career.
Does it feel real now? Or is there still that feeling of like, at some point, if this music thing doesn't work out for me, I'm probably going to go and have to work in that supermarket. Is there a little bit of you that still feels that?
Well, I don't think of myself as definitely a lifer. I'm like, yeah, I might do something totally different if the mood strikes. I keep finding music as one of the best things I can do with my time. If I find a better one, I'll do that.
Can you remember the first concert that you played, the first time you stood up? First time in front of a paying audience in some form. What was that like and what can you remember from it?
Well, I started out playing at open mics. I would always play at open mics alone.
Right.
And I learned to perform for strangers that way. I wonder if there was ever a paying audience for me before I had the band. Yeah, performing alone seems like it goes way back into my, recedes into the mists of time. But I really do remember the first time I played with a band, the band we formed in college, Ezra Furman and the Harpoons.
Mm-hmm.
It was just at a little university dining hall, basically.
Right.
Yeah, I instantly recognized it as like, this is different. This is a bigger thing is possible here. As much as I love solo performers and thought I was interesting as a solo songwriter, to have the drums and the bass and the other guitars, some liftoff happens. And I felt it the first time I ever played with the band. It feels like no one is doing it by themselves. It's just happening and you are like lifted into the air in this magical, addictive way. That's hard to explain. And it is totally different. I think I was hooked. I want to be a sheep. For so long, howling up toward the moon, I devoured the defenseless sheep like balloons that were tied to a railing and would anyway soon be deflated. I met you in between my carnivorous meals, and your hair was so soft and your body was real, and the layers of leaves blew away to reveal a new pathway. Trying to hide my love away, be discreet, but your reason to change and end my violent streak, a reason to be normal, a reason to bleed like a sheep. I just wanna be a sheep. I just wanna be a sheep, following right along with the crowds, a balloon with my head floating up through the clouds, and a little white string holding me to the ground. Could that be you? It could be you. Oh, I just wanna be a sheep. Oh, well, da 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 da. Now the clock on the wall plays a sinister game. It treats every 12 hours exactly the same. You cannot return, you can't get away, it keeps going. And everything you've done you can never undo, so I know that it's useless to try and be new. But when you keep your eye on me steady and blue, I keep trying anyways. And that eye watching me makes me not wanna hurt. I don't want to drool any more blood on your shirt, and I don't wanna stay.
the dirt. I need sleep. I just wanna be a sheep. I just wanna be a sheep and be gentle and docile and dumb. And to hear a voice call me and know I must come. And a shepherd to lead me and forget where I'm from. Could that be you? It could be you. I just wanna be a sheep. Okay. Yes, I am the one who's been killing the flock. I admit it. And now that you're over the shock, would you take me and keep me and turn back the clock? With your pretty little hand, I just wanna be a sheep. Oh, I just wanna be a sheep. Woo! Oh, 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 oh.
We should probably talk about the Velvet Underground, who I know are a big influence. I was watching an interview that you were doing with John Cale at the end of the Road Festival. I mean, as someone that like really loves the Velvets, I was watching that thinking, how terrified were you? Because he's great, but like he's not, he's John Cale. I mean, tell me about your love for the Velvets and tell me about meeting one of the godheads of like almost everything.
The Velvet Underground are foundational. I think they still remain probably my favorite band. I don't right. think I've ever found one that does it for me like they do. It was insane to meet John Cale. This is a mythic person in my imagination who has made things that really have shaped me and inspired me. And I also have had the experience of people meeting me who think that I'm special. And they're very, I mean, once in a while, there's somebody who's like starstruck by me. And to have been on that side of it, I know that it, so many people must be starstruck to meet John Cale. And you know, he's thinking, like, I'm just a person. I'm a person. No need to be weird. So I tried to not be weird. And I also recognized him as like, we do the same thing and we do have something in common. I don't know if I succeeded as a interviewer. The other thing is I don't usually ask the questions. I'm not usually the interviewer. So I, that was another thing. I would have been nervous about it, whoever I would interview as the interviewer for the first time. But it being him, yeah, it was surreal. But also, this is the guy in a band. I know guys in bands.
Did you ever meet Lou?
I did meet Lou Reed, yes. For 5 seconds.
Tell me about that.
This is the reason I'm not more ambitious, because I like had the greatest possible moment in my music career, like when I was still, I think, 21, when we had just started a band. Somehow we got asked to play on this tribute to Lou Reed at the South by Southwest Festival. And so we played two songs of his, and literally while we were on stage, Lou Reed came into the crowd and started taking pictures of us.
What?
He's like in the second row down there, and we're just like hyperventilating. And then, yeah, I talked to him for like 5 seconds after our show. I had done a solo acoustic version of the song Heroin, believe it or not.
Nice.
And he said that was good. He asked me if I was on heroin. And I said no. He said good. Anyway, it's a sort of shocking thing when I was just starting out.
I don't know just where I'm going. I'm going to try for the kingdom, if I can, 'cause it makes me feel like I'm a man. When I put a spike into my
begins to flow. When it shoots up the dropper's neck, when I'm closing in on them,
let's talk about the Year of No Reckoning 2012, first release under just your name. What do you remember from that record?
The Year of No Returning. My band hadn't like officially broken up, my college band, but I was like, I think I need to do something more alone and just with other people and try something different out. I think for some reason, me and my band had reached a, I don't know, this happens to bands. We got stuck in a rut and I was like, well, I want to go do something where I don't run everything by my bandmates and stuff. So I just shoestring the whole thing. I had no money to spend, but I did a little fan fundraiser through Kickstarter.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And, you know, I had just enough people who were willing to help me out that I got it recorded in the studio in the attic of where I had been living. It was like I moved into this place where my housemate Tim had a studio on the top floor. It was just there and I was living there. I was like, I gotta go up there, I gotta do something in there. And it turned out to be kind of a new beginning.
Nice that people crowdfunded it, though. That's got to be a sweet feeling.
Yeah, I know. And I don't know what I would have done because I wasn't on a label anymore and I just self-released it. I look at the years like 2012, 2013, 2011. I don't know how I got by. I was just scraping by.
So when does that kind of change? Is that like when my zero kind of starts to be, okay, well, people are starting to hear that track especially, and all of a sudden there's talk and there's your songs start to go ahead of you. Could you feel that shift around that point? Because people love that song. People kind of really dug it.
Yeah, it's your island, your United Kingdom. The British people took to our 2013 release, Day of the Dog. We put it out and went on tour in the U.S. for like 2 months or something, and it just nobody came to the shows. And
really?
Yeah, no, there was no. It was sort of this difficult, sometimes a bit miserable, long slog, and I was like, this album is good and it's the best I can do and it's not connecting and it's maybe this whole thing is sort of a waste of time. I made this resolution that I was maybe gonna quit
really
being a touring musician. As I made that decision and we finished up that North American tour, right then it was like, hey, you just got 5 stars in The Guardian. Hey, this festival wants to book you. Hey, this NME reviewed, gave you a good review, and they're playing your songs on Six Music. Not that I knew what that was, on the BBC every day. And I was like, but I thought I was going to quit. But maybe this is not the time to quit. and then we started going overseas.
I didn't realize it got so bad over there that you were like, maybe this just isn't the thing. And then we gave you some love. That's nice.
Forever grateful, you know, to certain, like Mark Riley just started playing it all the time. And, but yeah, it was like sort of just enough to keep us going. We thought maybe we'd do one last tour because they wanted to book us in the UK. And so we came over. We were like, this might be the last hurrah for us. And then we came to these shows and they were all sold out and the people like knew the words and we were just sort of like had to be like, wow, maybe we don't throw in the towel just yet.
Let's pick another artist that means a lot to you.
Nina Simone was a slow burn. I thought I heard something in college, I heard something after college. Each thing I heard by her was sort of like deeper than the last. I think it's when I realized that she was a protest singer and the depth of that, that she could make pop songs into protest songs. It was certainly an obsession that just deepened throughout my 20s. I think it was really when I heard Mississippi Goddamn, that song. Still one of the finest songs I've ever heard. I think if they're on a list of protest songs, that would be number one. There's so much in it. I wish I could do anything with half the pathos of that. It feels exactly, it has rage and despair and confusion. It has more emotions than you might expect from what you'd call a protest song. It's even almost funny. It is kind of funny. It kind of takes you through the whole human response to tragedy and injustice. She says, I've even stopped believing in prayer. Like, it just cuts so close to the bone. A lot of protest songs are very like, they just feel like public and they're not in the emotions of the author. They're sort of like these public events, but this one is so emotionally present. And I think it's like a guide for me as like, what music like that is made for. It's not just to make a statement in public. It's like a spiritual check-in at its best. It's like a, this is what it feels like. This is what it honestly feels like to live in this world where racists bomb buildings and kill children. And yeah. So it remains a kind of a guiding light.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Lurleen Wallace has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Can't you see it? I know you can feel it. It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Say a prayer. Alabama has got me so upset, and Memphis has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Hound dogs on my trail, little school children sitting in jail. Black cat crossed my path. I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on this land of mine. We all gonna get it in due time. Cause I don't belong here.
I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer. I've been there, so I know. You keep on saying go slow. Well, that's just the trouble. Washing the windows. Picking the cotton. Nothing but rotten. Too damn lazy. Thinking's crazy. Try to do my very best. Stand up, be counted with all the rest. Cause everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! Now you heard him. He's one of you. If you have been moved at all, and you know my songs at all, for God's sakes, join me. Don't sit back there. The time is too late now. Good God. You know, the king is dead. The king of love is dead. I ain't about to be nonviolent, honey. Oh, dude. Picket lines, school boycotts. They try to say it's a communist plot, but all I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me. And I loved him because he believed it. He lived by it. But you lie. Just like a lady, and you stop calling my mama Aunt Sadie. Hear me now. But my country is full of lies. We all gonna die and die like flies. But I don't trust nobody anymore. Keep on saying go slow. That's just the trouble.
No.
Desegregation.
No.
Mass participation.
No.
Unification.
No.
Do things gradually.
No.
We bring more tragedy.
No.
Why don't you see it? Why don't you feel it? I don't know. I don't know. You don't have to live next to me. Give me my equality, cause everybody knows about Mississippi. Everybody knows about Alabama. Everybody knows about Mississippi. God damn. That's it.
I wanted to ask you about the idea of protest songs, because 12 Nudes felt very much like it was concerned with the Trump administration, concerned with, you know, protest songs is always a bit of a simple way of putting it, but like, am I missing the protest music that is a response to what's going on at the moment? Because one would expect it's happening in the States to provoke more protest songs, for want of a better phrase.
That's a good question. There's always protest music happening. There might be more of some kind of widespread fatigue. I don't know. I do think that in that first Trump term, I was going to this place of all-out anger and panic, kind of, with 12 Nudes. And I started to search for a more sustainable kind of stance of opposition.
Right.
And that's part of what our next album, All of Us Flames, was. It's like, how do you oppose inhumanity for the long haul? How do you, like, take care of yourself and take care of others since the empire will not fall tomorrow.
The quote, I think you said, being trans is inseparable from being under siege. And it's like, if that siege just goes on and on and on, as you say, like, how do you not burn yourself out? No one can be angry all the time, but if things that are prompting you to be angry are constant, then I don't know. How do you respond?
Well, I've never lived in a world without glaring injustices. That's the world we live in. And the stance of love and justice, like, it can't be something that eats you alive. There has to be room for joy alongside that anger. Sometimes I think anger, I'm not always sure it helps. I already know how the poor are treated in our society and have been my entire life. And so I just have to sort of make sure I have enough energy to do something to help.
I have to ask you, as I'm sure everybody does, especially in the UK, and the first for this question would be, when did you first get the call about getting involved with sex education?
Oh.
I'm a big fan of Harold and Maude. I'm a big fan of The Graduate. I love those films where the music is kind of, I don't know, it's not even complimentary. It's an actual character in those two movies. And I think in sex education, if you tried to write or choose an artist to write something for that, conventionally, the music wouldn't work in those places, but it does. It's like having an extra cast member. And I think that's why people respond to it so much.
It was a dream gig. The thing is, they were like, this is our show. We want you to do music for it. Just go. We want the music to sound like you. They didn't really constrain me in any way. They told me a lot of what they wanted their show to be. And I also grilled them because I was like, what kind of show is this? Wait, teenagers having sex? Explain this to me. It's so feminist and it's so like, it's just sane about sex. And I just found it to be such a healthy show in lots of ways. And I hadn't seen that really on TV before, certainly not when I was a teenager. So I just feel lucky to have been asked to do it. And, you know, it turned out also to be a place to put a lot of the part of me that still feels like a teenager. It was nice to like have this context to spur me to embrace those dramatic teenage feelings and write songs in that register.
I've got secrets I don't know.
Let's talk about the new record. You went back to Chicago, right?
Yes.
Why and why did it work?
I mean, Chicago was the best place to do it for a lot of like logistical reasons that are boring. We did also go back to the first person I ever made a record with, Brian Deck, a Chicago-based producer, who I had not seen since 2008 when I last recorded with him.
Really? That long ago? That's so
yes,
sweet.
Yes.
Oh, wow. How was that?
It was so great. He's just great at what he does, and it was very different, obviously. I like learned how to make records in that time span. You know, when we first recorded together, I had no idea what I was doing. And we had a very tight budget and we were just like, I don't know, this is our band. Could start recording when we start playing and sound good, you know? And he did. He made it sound great. But this time we actually got to like, you know, I don't know, do more. So we still did record the band live. But yeah, I think in returning to him and in returning to Chicago, it was some kind of like feeling of like returning to childhood or something, or the rawness of youth, a starting over from the first place I ever made a record. And oddly, that just suited this album, I think. It comes from this kind of raw place, and it feels like it's pouring out of me, is the feeling I get.
I don't know of a single artist that if you said to them, oh, would you like to just be that you right at the start, just for a bit again, and feel like you did just then. I don't know there's an artist that wouldn't want to experience it for a while at least, because it's different when you start. So did you feel like you were going back and some of those characteristics, some of that mindset, some of that explosion of everything was kind of coming out in the same way with this album that it used to, do you think?
Well, I've become, I think, a much better songwriter and much better at making albums. And there's a lot of differences. There is a giving up of control. That I think that's what reminds me of youth about this record, that like I found that all of the songs I was writing were about this sense of losing control, being overwhelmed by beauty or pain or just the hugeness of feelings. I don't know. I think the narrator of this record is sort of like has become a child again or something. It's all kind of mysterious to me.
Have you ever been to where I'm going? Have you ever been?
Find things to say about these mysterious compositions and recordings I've made, but they are really beyond me. I don't understand where they come from. They come from a dark water in the back of my mind. and I don't know what's back there. I just reach in and pull something out, and if it's beautiful, I share it.
Was there one song that kind of unlocked the rest of the record? Was there one that you completed writing it or completed getting it on tape? You're like, okay, now I know where the whole thing's heading. Now I've opened the door, it's got an identity, because this one song has kind of pointed the way for the rest of them.
When I wrote and made a demo of Set in Storm, I was like, okay, all right, I am going to make another record, it's true. That's the thing about me, I don't take it for granted that I'll continue. I feel like I don't need to make another album. Maybe I'll just get a job as a waitress. But then these songs show up and I'm like, okay, yes, it's gotta be a record. We've gotta do it. So yeah, no, I had a few going, but I was like, you know, these could come to nothing or these could end up anywhere. And then Sudden Storm landed on me, and also the song Grand Mal. Actually, I wrote these two songs on the same day, and I was like, okay, this is becoming a piece. And then you start to get obsessed with it, and you're like, okay, here's how it's gonna be this whole 42-minute experience that interlocks with itself and self-references, and my writing brain gets excited at that point.
What did you learn about yourself doing this record?
I was afraid to say some of what's on this record. I was writing that song, Submission. It's really a song that has despair in it, a sort of acceptance of defeat and a hopelessness. And I was writing it and I was like, I can't write these lines. I can't proclaim despair. That's the opposite of what I want to say to people. I've always been anti-despair, and I think I ended up embracing a song about feeling totally hopeless, defeated, and despairing, because it's all right to feel that way. No feeling is final, is what Rainer Maria Rilke, the poet, wrote. Just keep going. Find out what's behind that feeling, what comes after that feeling. So, yeah, there's something in this that was like giving up the party line and just admitting how you feel. And it's just, it's all right to feel that way. You know, I don't have to rally the troops at every moment, and I can feel overwhelmed, defeated. I can show weakness. It's not the end of the story, yes. But I think to give a space to feel things like that, that's part of the function of art, to let those feelings have their moment.
And the final thing, what song shall we end on? I'd like you to pick a track to finish the show.
We closed our record with a cover of Alex Walton's I Need the Angel. And I love our version, but I'd be very happy to play Alex Walton's version of I Need the Angel from her 2020 album Shame Music, which blew my mind and changed my life.
Why?
As soon as I heard it. I think part of it is that I saw in her songwriting a willingness to feel the feelings that you don't want to admit that you feel, or let go some control of what you're saying to the world, and let it blurt, let it bleed. She just writes in a way I wish I could write, and I think I'm learning to.
Then that's the song we're going to finish on. It's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you so much.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I feel my body rising like so many red blue jeans. place to be. I'm in the excavator. I'm holding knives in my mouth. It's that obligation since I was forced to move down south. I'm in Port Chicago, waiting on my angel to report. She's got 20 faces, and her hair's 8 miles short. I'm a duty angel. She sure is.
I Need the Angel by Alex Walton, the final choice to my guest here on The First Time, Ezra Furman. And thank you to Ezra for being my guest today. And that's the end of this show. I'll be back tomorrow with another brand new episode of The First Time for this season, where my guest will be from Skunk Anansie, Skin. And of course, you can listen back to previous First Time shows on BBC Sounds, including our latest episode with Jim Moyer, also known as Vic Reeves, as well as Liam Gallagher and Janelle Monáe. Until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
About you, the brother of suspense, finish, let him in.